Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip B. Stieg, and I have with me this evening Dr. Stephen A. Paget, the Physician-in-Chief at the Hospital for Special Surgery and Chairman of the Department of Rheumatology. He leads the largest rheumatology division in the world. To quote Dr. Paget, "This is your only body. Use it wisely." Listen to the remainder of the show and find out how you can protect your joints, muscles, and tendons. Please stay with us. Good evening, and welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm with Dr. Stephen A. Paget. Dr. Paget is Physician-in-Chief at the Hospital for Special Surgery and Chairman of the Department of Rheumatology at that institution. Dr. Paget is an internationally acclaimed physician in the area of rheumatology with specialties in the area of immunopathogenesis of rheumatoid arthritis. He has helped build the largest rheumatology staff in the world, and it is a distinct pleasure to have you here, Steve. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
So, when I talk to my friends before doing this show, who are not physicians, I ask them, you know, what do you think a rheumatologist does? And they all kind of sat there, and you know, I didn't get very many quick responses. Can you enlighten us? What do you do day to day?
Sure. So there are two main musculoskeletal specialists. Those are people who focus on muscles, joints, bones. One's an orthopedic surgeon, and they're surgeons, although they take care of other medical problems related to the bones and joints. And then there are rheumatologists, and we take care of joint problems, inflammation, problems that relate to overuse and irritation, aging. We're internists as opposed to surgeons, so obviously our focus is on medications, avoidance of problems, and trying to improve the quality and quantity of people's lives.
So you deal with a lot of aches and pains.
Indeed.
And what I don't want to do to you is, if there's a million people out there, hopefully there's a million people out there listening to this, all of a sudden you get 500,000 phone calls because I've got an ache in my foot or I've got an ache in my shoulder. What patient should start thinking about calling a rheumatologist?
I think it's important for patients that are listening to appreciate the fact that aches and pains are a common problem in life. The times when you should start to think about seeing a doctor in general, let alone a rheumatologist, is when those aches and pains are persistent. They last for more than a few days or a few weeks. They're severe, meaning they limit your function. And they're associated with other manifestations, such as fatigue, fever, skin rash, eye inflammation, back pain, weight loss. So it's not the weekend warrior who has a problem because they haven't played tennis for 10 years, and they play over a weekend and they have a few aches and pains. But it's more the persistence of the problem. And the most important thing that people listening should appreciate is the fact that when there is persistence of a problem, it's important to present to either your internist or a rheumatologist. Because if there's any time in history that we can do things to prevent, stop, or limit damage to joints, that is now.
So I presume most of your patients then don't come off the street. They come from other doctors. What types of diseases, if you can give us a list of things that are commonly seen by a rheumatologist?
So the most common disorder that exists today is osteoarthritis. It's a wear and tear type of arthritis that often occurs as people get older. It's sometimes due to trauma in the past, like a knee problem in the setting of football or sports. And that is a problem that has quite characteristic presentation. First of all, it's not a systemic general disease. So people don't feel fatigued. They don't have fever. They don't have weight loss. But they'll have a single joint or a few joints that are bothersome at the tips of their fingers, a knee, their back, their neck. And it usually leads to some mild limitation in function, which often can just go away without the overuse that causes it or with a few over-the-counter medications. Obviously, osteoarthritis can lead to significant joint problems, and the most common reason why people have joint replacements is because of osteoarthritis in a hip or a knee. But that's not a very common thing, and obviously today in research at institutions like ours and others, we're trying to really get and focus on the cause of that and trying to prevent it. While it's the most common cause of joint problems, it's the one we know least about, unfortunately.
You mentioned earlier the weekend warrior, and for those of us like you who are baby boomers, and we go out there and try to overdo it, does that kind of activity predispose you to the development of an osteoarthritis in a particular joint?
Well, certainly overuse of a joint to the point of really very bad trauma or a meniscal tear where cartilage
the meniscus is
a part of the joint, knee, for example. Once that develops, and it's common, for example, in football players and people who overuse or damage their joints, if that leads to enough change within the knee, for example, it can eventuate in osteoarthritis down the road. That can be quite significant. Mm-hmm. Most things are simple, self-limited, and short-lived problems so that you can get through them and live on in your life. But some, especially if there's a predisposition in a family, for example, it could be more significant. Rheumatoid arthritis is another disorder that we take care of a lot at Hospital for Special Surgery, and rheumatologists do in general. That's to be distinguished quite significantly from osteoarthritis that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. Rheumatoid arthritis is a systemic disease, which means that it not only has center stage in the joints, but also can cause other manifestations, fatigue, weight loss. It can affect internal organs. It affects multiple joints, and unless controlled, will cause joint damage that can be irreparable. Very, very different entity than osteoarthritis. And what's most important there is, and we've learned this from our brethren in Europe, the development of early arthritis centers, where people get in within the first month or so of the onset of the illness, can have a profound effect as to whether that illness is going to be stopped in its tracks or go on to develop problems down the road.
I'll get back to the rheumatoid arthritis, but because you said it is the most common thing that you see, and we see so many people running in Central Park and up and down the river, I want to stay with the osteoarthritis. And it's a twofold question. Number one, what can we do to prevent injury to joints? What shoes, whatever, the routine kinds of things. And number two, if we start getting that soreness, is it wrong to start taking these non-steroidals and other medications over the counter?
Right. So obviously with any kind of illness, there's a wide spectrum of potential problems. With regular living, with no trauma to the joints, people can still get aches and pains. But over-the-counter Tylenol or Advil or those types of medicines can be quite helpful in controlling those problems. If somebody, for example, runs, it's very important to appreciate a few things. First of all, it's important to prepare for the run. Make sure that your muscles are in appropriate position, strength, to avoid excessive trauma to the joint. Weight control is very, very important. Let me give you an example. The knee and the hip, because of their mechanics, see a single pound of weight fivefold. So if you don't have arthritis, weight control is tremendously important with regard to the trauma and stress that your joint sees. If you do have arthritis, your joints are very pleased by any weight loss because the trauma minute by minute from everyday activity will be much, much less. So being in good shape, good joint mechanics, stretching and doing those activities before you run or before various types of sports activities, and optimization of weight is all very important. And with all of the disorders that we're going to talk about today, your family history is key. Because obviously all of us have half our mother's genes and half our father's genes. And if indeed they have had a problem in the past, you should take book on that. Just like if they've had colon cancer, you need to get colonoscopies. If they've had lung cancer, if you smoke, that's a real problem because you already have a genetic predisposition. So being in control of your health, being an informed consumer overall in general health and particularly musculoskeletal health is very important. And using your family history and your own past history as a guide to the future is key.
The pat answer to if you're going to go out and start doing exercising, you should do it under the guidance of a trainer. Let's face it, not everybody can afford to go out and get a personal trainer. Where can John Q. Public go and get some information on the, is it on the internet? Where do they go? Are there sites about how to protect their joints and their muscles and tendons?
Yes, there are many, many different sites. There's the rheumatology site at Hospital for Special Surgery. That's www.hss.edu. There are sites from general rheumatology committees and structures. One, www.rheumatology.org. That's the American College of Rheumatology. And they can also get information from local societies, the American College of Rheumatology, the Arthritis Foundation. All of these have information that's important to know about, either when you're starting to be active or if you start to develop problems when you're active.
So I've got 100 people, and I bring them into your office. You know, just statistically, what's the likelihood that someone's going to develop osteoarthritis?
I would say probably 20 out of that 100 will have osteoarthritis. Also of interest is the fact that if you happen to go for an x-ray for something else, they may find osteoarthritis on that x-ray, and you may be totally asymptomatic, have no complaints whatsoever. So the presence of arthritis is almost universal as people get older. Mm-hmm. But that it becomes symptomatic and problematic is a very, very different thing. But out of those 100 people, probably 20 of them will have some symptom down the road related to osteoarthritis. Many fewer rheumatoid arthritis, mm-hmm. and many fewer some of the other problems we'll be talking about today.
And that's all the joints, you know, spine, hips, knees.
Exactly.
Okay. So you said earlier that rheumatoid arthritis is more of a systemic problem. Is it genetic?
There are genetic factors and also environmental factors. And just as we talked about with osteoarthritis, you may have a predisposition through your parents. And if you played football or play tennis, you may very well not only have the genetic predisposition, but also the environmental factors. In rheumatoid arthritis, it's a similar thing. There are genetic predispositions, but also environmental factors like viruses. So the genetics are necessary, but not necessarily sufficient to cause the problem. You have to come upon something else, some other trigger that causes it to happen. In rheumatoid arthritis, it could be a virus. There are other disorders that are cousins to rheumatoid arthritis where drugs or sunlight may be a trigger.
Something that simple, sunlight. Right. So you're saying you have to have both the genetic predisposition and that trigger.
That's
correct. Can't happen independent of...
That's exactly right.
Well, I want to continue on this, but right now we have to take a brief break. Please stay with How to Save Your Life and our conversation with Dr. Stephen A. Padgett, Physician-in-Chief and Chairman of the Department of Rheumatology at the Hospital of Special Surgery. We'll be right back. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I am with Dr. Stephen A. Paget, Physician-in-Chief and Chairman of the Department of Rheumatology at the Hospital for Special Surgery. Before the break, Steve and I were discussing rheumatoid arthritis, and we talked about the combination of environmental and genetic factors that cause a firing and initiation of the disease. So when we say initiation, what happens?
So let's talk a little bit about the immune system first. Each of you listening today have had a virus of some kind. You have runny nose, sniffles, cough, you're fatigued, you've got this bone-chilling fatigue that keeps you in bed, you have fevers. And within a 2 or 3 days, the stalwarts, the wonder of your immune system, takes care of it, and you go on with your life. That immune system is there to protect you against foreign invaders. Unfortunately, with disorders like rheumatoid arthritis, the body is not set correctly with regard to the immune system. So an abnormal trigger like a virus, for example, may set up an immune reaction that doesn't help you but actually hurts you. So the same immune system that allowed you to get over that flu one day starts to attack you. That's called autoimmunity. So the body starts reacting against itself. And so whatever the trigger was initially doesn't even have to be there anymore. But the body starts to develop a chronic disorder where the joints are center stage as far as the inflammation. Once that self-perpetuating inflammation gets started, unless we stop it, unless we bring down the thermostat of the inflammation, the overreactive inflammation, the joints are going to be damaged. And once joints are damaged, it becomes self-perpetuating. It becomes more damaged, and mechanical problems occur. So what we've learned over the past 5 or 10 years, amazingly, is the character of the immune system in rheumatoid arthritis and also how to control it. And hopefully in the future with osteoarthritis, which is a different type of disorder, we'll learn the same things. In the 1900s, the plagues of society were tuberculosis, polio, syphilis, rheumatic fever. They don't exist anymore because we came upon a new model and concept of infections, and we were able to develop antibiotics that got rid of it. We hope to do similar things in disorders such as rheumatoid arthritis. Back in the 1880s, somebody at Hospital for Special Surgery found that if a person developed an infection near a tumor, the tumor would go away. He actually stimulated infections near tumors and made them go away. And what was in those infections was a chemical called TNF, or tumor necrosis factor.
Now, we just need to alert the public that we can't have them going around trying to get infected for treatment of their tumors.
Absolutely not. Of course not. Yeah. And that would never get past our oversight now.
Right.
But what we learned from that is that there are chemicals in the body that cause the damage and the fatigue. We now have antibodies against that. And we're using them in rheumatoid arthritis. And the amazing part about it is that it completely stops damage to zero. Let me just mention an important fact for patients. In 1985, I did an outcome study for patients who had total knee replacements. 25% of the patients who needed total knee replacements had rheumatoid arthritis as the cause of the damage that led to the knee replacement. The rest had osteoarthritis. Now only 5% of patients have rheumatoid arthritis. We have turned that disease around on its head because we understood its character, its personality, and we became equally aggressive to its personality and instituted therapy early with new amazing medicines that basically dampen the inflammatory response and stop damage.
So in 1985, when 20% of the patients were undergoing hips, knees, whatever, because of rheumatoid arthritis, compare their life now in terms of functionality to the patient in 2006? Is the length of their life the same? Is the quality of the life, how is it different?
A very important point. Rheumatoid arthritis and its inflammation has a negative spillover effect on blood vessels. So the collateral damage of rheumatoid arthritis is premature atherosclerosis or coronary artery disease. So you get a twofer here. If I can control your rheumatoid arthritis, I can not only improve your functional state and your quality of life, but its length by decreasing atherosclerosis. And so research into one area can help other areas. And clearly in rheumatoid arthritis, we've made tremendous strides. So we not only improve function, but prolong life.
Mac, again, I'm aging myself in terms of my awareness of this field, but when I was growing up, steroids were the therapy of choice. Are they still used? Are they used as much? And can you differentiate the kind of steroids you use versus the kind of steroids the athletes
Sure.
might be using and the side effects?
So let me tell you another story. Let's go back to World War II. It was found that people with rheumatoid arthritis would get better during pregnancy. So some scientists tried to figure out why that would be. And what they found was that it was probably related to the steroids that were spewed out during pregnancy. They then have found that adrenal glands contained hormones that would suppress inflammation. During World War II, the Luftwaffe used steroids to allow their pilots to fly higher than our pilots. Obviously, we won the war, and the government gave steroids over to Merck and other companies to develop. In 1951, the Nobel Prize was won for the use of steroids in rheumatoid arthritis. And then it was thought to be a miracle and a cure. It wasn't a cure. And we soon found out when doses that were too high were used, patients developed severe side effects, diabetes, thinning of the bone, infections, mood problems, and weakness. And so what we found over the years is, in a balanced way, if in the first year or so of rheumatoid arthritis, small doses are used, they can actually be disease-modifying, like some of the drugs that I mentioned before. But you don't want to use them for too long and in too high a doses. Now, they are to be distinguished from the androgen steroids, which bodybuilders use, some baseball players and maybe football players use. That's a very, very different steroid. That is not an anti-inflammatory steroid. As a matter of fact, it can have tremendously negative effects upon the body, on the liver, on the mood, as well as other changes in people's personality. So they're very, very different entities. And recent studies from Europe have demonstrated that small doses of the cortisone-type medicines, for which they won the Nobel Prize in the 1950s, can actually be effective. And they're amazing medicines. But like with all medicines, they're double-edged swords. On one hand, they're amazing. On the other hand, they have side effects. And in rheumatoid arthritis, we're still treating what we call the pathogenesis, which means what immune problems lead to rheumatoid arthritis. We don't know the etiology. Like in infectious diseases, we know that bacteria or viruses cause a problem, and we may have an antibiotic that stops it. We're still not there yet, but we're moving towards that in rheumatoid arthritis.
So the medicines you're using are not curing you, but they're certainly staving off the impact of the overactive autoimmune disease.
Exactly.
You mentioned during that discussion the topic of osteoporosis. Are we just more aware of it now, or is it more common? And if it's more common, why are we seeing it more now?
First of all, it's awareness. There's no doubt about the fact that the National Osteoporosis Foundation has had an impact. Our understanding of what osteoporosis is, and also the incredible medicines that we now have that can stop the development of osteoporosis. So it's all of those things. But very importantly, the population is aging. Medicine in general is better. Society is better. So people are aging. And as they age, they can develop some of those problems that relate to aging. Osteoarthritis, like we talked about before, and certainly osteoporosis. And while osteoporosis is more common in women...
Just for some people who don't mind, what is osteoporosis?
Osteoporosis means thinning of the bones.
Is it a reabsorption?
Well, let me tell you what it is. At 30 years of age, a woman has the highest peak bone mass, which means the amount of bone that they have. And then it starts to wane. And it particularly starts to decrease. That means the amount of bone they have after menopause. And so, in actuality, the seed of thinning of the bone occurs very early in life. And so it's very important for people to appreciate they need to be active. They need to take calcium and vitamin D supplements over time and more as you get older. They need to avoid those things that worsen the amount of bone that they have. Alcohol, smoking, and things like that are very, very important to appreciate. And certainly, if somebody, for example, has a fracture, it's very important to appreciate that that's a sentinel event in their life. And if they weren't on bone-protecting medicines, they must be put on it.
So someone's going to run off to the General Nutritional Center now and start buying calcium supplements. Can you do too much?
Yes, you can have too much calcium. Obviously, it should be guided. They can go to the National Osteoporosis Foundation website, NOF, I think it is, .org, and they can get information, and it's changing over time. As the population ages, we understand more what people should take or shouldn't take. But as with everything, there's a golden mean. There's a balance that you have to strike. And being an informed consumer of medical care is key. And as you get older, it's particularly important.
As you were talking, I was thinking about these, you know, when you watch the football games and other things like that, you see these advertisements now with people coming on, and it's people in their 50s and talking about their osteoporosis. Is industry driving this too much?
Well, the whole issue of industry is a very complicated one. On the one hand, they have lots of money and they can get the word out there. They're a corporate entity and they want to make more money. But however we get the information out to people, whether it's on websites like the ones we've talked about in the past, whether it's through reading, through the internet, or television, I think it's important to understand the problems. Osteoporosis is in some ways epidemic, especially as people get older. And particularly in the setting of amazing new medicines called bisphosphonates. And you've heard some of them, Fosamax, Actonil, Boniva. These are excellent medicines. And they can actually, like I mentioned in rheumatoid arthritis, stop the loss of bone, stabilize it, if not improve it, so that people do not fracture. Fracture itself either can be a manifestation of an overall deterioration in somebody's health, or when it occurs, it has to be a trigger to the patient, their family, and a doctor to do something if they hadn't before.
It seems to me intuitively that if a patient has osteoporosis and they go on and have a fracture, that your ability to manage that is going to be much more difficult than the routine garden variety fracture because of the bad bone. What additional things do you have to do in that scenario?
Well, certainly you have to get a full picture of the person's health at that moment. Why did it happen? Two, what their nutritional status is, what their medical status is, and certainly given the fact that they've had that sentinel event of a fracture, which is a definition of the fact that osteoporosis not only exists, but can lead to fracture, you have to become much more aggressive. Doing a bone density, putting them on a bisphosphonate, making sure that they're on the right calcium and vitamin D supplementation. But let me just say this. just as with a decubitus ulcer that people get as a bed sore. In rheumatoid arthritis, the development of an erosion or joint damage. In osteoporosis relating to a fracture, we want to prevent it because often you can't pull it back once it's occurred. So prevention is the key in all of these diseases. Understanding what the possibilities are, getting to the appropriate doctor, and understanding what the options are before problems occur.
Along those lines, then, should patients be getting body scans, CT scans, bone x-rays, bone scans? What should they be thinking about? And once they do see you, what kind of diagnostic workup can they expect? You know, what should they proactively do to prevent it on their own? And once they have the problem, what happens?
So first of all, they have to understand what osteoporosis is and isn't, what personal things they can do to prevent it, meaning exercise, good nutrition, taking calcium and vitamin D supplements, certainly understanding those things that predispose to it and trying to avoid them, and getting a bone density test. For example, we talked about steroids before. Anybody that's put on those cortisone-type steroids needs to get a baseline bone density because steroids can cause osteoporosis. If somebody has a family history of osteoporosis and they determine when that began in their mother, for example, they should start to become more concerned and be assessed for that. Get a bone density. It's a simple test. It can determine where you fit relative to those women at 30 years of age who have peak bone mass. And if indeed you have either what's called osteopenia, which is a little bit of bone loss, or osteoporosis, which is more bone loss, there are now excellent therapies that can stop that in its tracks, help to reform the knitting of the bone and its strength, not just its amount, to prevent bone fractures.
So are you starting to recommend that at a certain point in a female's life, they should all get a bone density study?
Certainly postmenopausal females should get bone density studies. Medicare, for example, will pay for it every 2 years.
Really?
Because they understand the importance of it. Because they also pay for the hip fractures. They also pay for the other problems that occur related to hip fractures. With people that are much older, 70 or 80 years of age, those people who have a hip fracture at 1 year have a significant mortality. So it is a very important event in somebody's life, both with regard to what it represents and what it means to the future. And it's something that you really want to prevent as much as possible.
We have to take a brief break. Please stay with us on How to Save Your Life. I'm with Dr. Stephen A. Padgett. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and again, I'm with Dr. Stephen A. Paget, the Physician-in-Chief at the Hospital for Special Surgery, and we've been talking about a number of rheumatologic disorders, including osteoarthritis, osteoporosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and I wanted to switch tracks now just because of the season and the prevalence here in the Northeast of Lyme disease. People, I think when they hear it, all of a sudden they get a little bit panic-stricken, certainly if their children have the problem. My nephew actually had it, and it really changed his life for a while. What is it?
So this is an extraordinary story, and let me go back 25 years. A few mothers in Lyme, Connecticut, found that a few of their children developed, quote, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis on the same street. And so they went to Alan Steer, who was the scientist at Yale at that time, and he just couldn't understand why that would be. And as an epidemiologist, he figured there must have been something in that street or in that area that might have triggered it. And that's how they found Lyme disease. Now, it's called Lyme disease because it was found in Lyme, Connecticut. But what it is an infection. Now, remember we talked a few minutes ago about rheumatoid arthritis, where you have a genetic predisposition and a trigger in the environment, say a virus, that causes a self-perpetuating illness. Well, there we still don't know what the cause is. In Lyme disease, we do. It's a specific type of bacteria that is injected into the body in May, June, or July by a specific type of tick. It's a deer tick, and it hides in the grass. And if you happen to walk past there, it jumps up on you, it takes its blood meal, and then over the next day it regurgitates the blood meal with the bacteria in it into your skin. The bacteria then disseminates around the body into the brain, the heart, and the joints.
This is sounding bad. Is there anything I can do to stop this before it happens?
Absolutely. Well, the important thing about it is the following. First of all, some people who have this happen to them don't get any problem. And that's probably related to genes and the amount of bacteria that was injected. But the important thing here is, as always, education and recognition. So Westchester in New York is ground zero for this in the world. But there are 45 states all the way around from Michigan down towards Florida in which Lyme disease exists. Recognition is key. And so if in that time of the month, the year, and any time during the year, somebody develops a skin rash, a big red rash with a central clearing or with a tick in it, or they develop aches and pains or headache or flu-type symptoms, it's very important to bring it to the attention of your doctor. Because most importantly, if it's caught early, you stop it completely from ever developing problems down the road. Now, if you give antibiotics like doxycycline, which is a tetracycline-type antibiotic, or amoxicillin, which is a penicillin-type antibiotic, if you give it for 2 or 3 weeks in the setting of that rash, the early aches and pains, it stops the problem completely in most people. Now, that's an amazing boon in medicine. And we hope to find the same thing in rheumatoid arthritis, but we don't know it. Now, there is a small percentage of patients that don't recognize it early on. They can develop quite significant arthritis in a single joint, or they can develop a neurologic problem like a face palsy, or even meningitis, a headache. They can even develop a heart arrhythmia. But even in those, once it's found out, by giving an antibiotic, you can get rid of it. So obviously you want to get it at its source in May, June, or July. But even if you don't, as long as somebody recognizes it by its classical symptoms and blood tests that you get, you can get rid of it completely. Now, there is a small percentage of patients who have had very obvious Lyme disease typical clinical manifestations and positive blood tests that get what's called a post-Lyme syndrome. And that means that despite the fact that the illness was appropriately treated in a timely manner, they can get what's called fibromyalgia, which is general aches and pains and soreness. Or they can get mild cognitive problems where they don't bring back facts and their memory is poor. But that's very uncommon. The story is an amazing one. It's a detective story that has a good ending. Early recognition, early therapy, you get rid of the problem.
So I'm struck by your animation. And you went to medical school at Downstate, you trained at Hopkins, you went to the NIH. You look like you're about my age. So back when you started getting interested in this stuff, patients weren't doing that well. Now you are giving incredible hope to patients with rheumatologic diseases. What is it that got you into this in the first place? And I presume, is it the cures that you're seeing now that keep you going?
I guess I have always had an interest in just being a good doc, and certainly also bringing new things that come from science to my patients. Rheumatologic problems tend to be chronic problems, and I like taking care of people with chronic problems, certainly also if I can get them over their problem as new advances come along that can be delivered to patients. I've always been somebody who's enjoyed the detective game, the Sherlock Holmes part of medicine. And I think medicine, as you know, is all about stimulating trust in a patient, opening up the lines of communication, filling out a personal tapestry of their life and the illness, and trying to make a diagnosis, sometimes in a very complex illness. And then also the immunology, as we talked about before. It's an amazing thing, and we're learning more and more about the immune system, its good effects and its negative effects, how to try to probe it and understand it, and also how to try to control it without developing problems like infections. So that's what it's been for me. And whether it's at a time in the 1960s and 70s and 80s when we didn't have amazing stuff, or the times now when we have incredible medicines, these immunological scalpels that very finely tune the immune system so that patients' lives are better, that's always what's gotten my juices flowing.
So it seems to me also that rheumatology is one of those, the mantra in medicine these days is translational research. And for the public, that's basically research that we do in the lab, and then it quickly translates into work that can be applied in the clinical setting. And that appears to be very vibrant in the field of rheumatology, with immunology and then the development of medications and quick translation to the patient. I mean, if you think about it, like you said, 20 years ago, you didn't have this. And within a period of 20 years, which is short in medicine, you're curing patients.
That's absolutely correct. The translation is the key. And the NIH has focused on that. They do indeed want to be the National Institute of Health, not the National Institute of Science. What that means is that things are moved from the laboratory to the patient as fast as possible. Now, I told you the story of one of the doctors at Special Surgery in 1885. He found this chemical, he didn't know what it was called, but found something in infection that made tumors go away. That was eventually cloned, a type of science, at Memorial Hospital just across the street in the 1960s. And in the last 10 or 15 years, scientists from around the world defined in animal models how centrally important TNF, or tumor necrosis factor, was. And when they did, pharmaceutical companies understood it, developed a new medication, and were now giving it to patients. There's no subspecialty in medicine in which more new immunological scalpels, biological agents that are developed in the test tube, from our knowledge, from science, is being used more in rheumatology than any other area. And that's what's so amazing about it. But we have to be ever careful because of that careful balance that has to be struck between controlling the immune system and causing problems. Because as I said before, the immune system is, for the most part, our friend, except in autoimmune diseases, where we need to bring down the thermostat of the inflammation.
What would be your suggestions? I mean, you know, the budget for the National Institute of Health is now being reduced. 10 years ago, it was jumped up significantly or bumped up significantly. Your field, I think, typifies the advantages that investment in science brings to public health. What would be your message to the public? Should they write our senators and our congressmen?
Yeah. This is such a key time. Whereas 10, 15 years ago, one in four grants that were sent to the NIH were funded. Now it's one in 11. 1,000 grants that used to be given out are no longer given out. And not only will there be fewer advances, but those scientists who are now in the field of science and immunology will leave it because they don't have the appropriate support. So what should the patients listening now do? At every cocktail party, mention this. Send letters to your congresspeople and senators. It's very important that they try to stimulate the appropriate prioritization. Lots of money on the war in Iraq. Lots of money for other things. People have to appreciate that there is an appropriate balance, and their health is held in the balance as well if monies are not supporting research.
Earlier we were talking about, you know, the fact that we are successful in medicine. People are living longer. In my subspecialty, the problem with that is they're living longer, and now I'm seeing a new subset of diseases. And I presume one of the diseases that you're starting to see is the secondary impact or the diseases related to cancers, because mm-hmm. patients are now developing new and different kinds of cancers.
Right.
How has that changed for you?
Well, as I mentioned before, there's clearly this interplay between cancer and inflammation and immunity. We are always forming tumor cells and killing them. We're always clotting and unclotting. The body is in balance. It's in homeostasis. It's amazing. But sometimes the system is negatively affected, either by some virus or a drug that we take. And so it's very important to appreciate that when the balance is changed, abnormalities and diseases can occur. We see from time to time patients who have cancers present with things that look just like autoimmune processes, just like rheumatoid arthritis. And so it's very important for us as internists, which rheumatologists are, to understand these facts. And in the people who are listening today, it's key that you keep up with all your age-appropriate cancer assessments, colonoscopies, prostate exams, mammograms, breast exams, testicular exams. All of these things are very, very important. And also to present to your internist, who is your traffic cop, things that are awry, weight loss that's unexplained, fevers that persist too long, glands that get swollen and don't retract after an infection. Things that are just not right. Some of these things will relate to me as a rheumatologist, and I can do a lot more now than I was able in the past. Some may be treated by other types of physicians. But a close and productive and communicative partnership with your doctor is absolutely key in maintaining your health.
Quickly, since we're beginning to run out of time, I think probably one of the common things you see on a day-to-day basis other than osteoarthritis is foot injuries.
Right.
People are out running and scooting around, doing skateboarding. What's the most common thing you see?
Overused tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, which is pain at the bottom of the foot because of over-irritation, spurs that develop because of overuse, stress fractures, not an uncommon thing, particularly in women. And so all of these things need to be appreciated by patients once they undertake a new type of activity that they didn't before.
So is it due to overuse, or are they wearing bad shoes? Are they,
you know, it's a combination of overuse, trauma that their body's not used to, inappropriate footwear, and also stretching, getting prepared, getting your body conditioned for the new traumas that it's going to undertake.
A couple of weeks ago, I was interviewing Riley Williams, and I was saying to him, you know, I'm a weekend warrior, and I don't stretch. And it's just, it's, for me, it's kind of a time thing. How long does somebody have to stretch daily?
10 or 15 minutes before you start going out and running. I think the information that you try to gather before you buy a television or a refrigerator or a computer should let you know that you need to do at least the same with regard to your health. So anything new that you either put in your body, that you do to your body, you need to become informed about it because it's the only body you were given.
With that final note, I'd like to say thank you to Dr. Stephen A. Paget, the Physician-in-Chief at the Hospital for Special Surgery, Chairman of the Department of Rheumatology, and leader of the largest rheumatology division in the world. It's been a great pleasure having you.
My pleasure.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Ken Ipp is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Shartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.